Hans moved over her with calm possessiveness, as though he handled some lovely thing that belonged only to him. Tears came to her again. Full of loneliness, she let herself be drawn into his embrace, but she could not suffer his touch unfeelingly. While a part of her yearned only to be held, to be drawn into a reassuring warmth, a safe harbor like the one in which Aidan Cloud rocked gently at harbor, untroubled by the storms that swept the great ocean, a different self wished to break free and run madly into danger. Still another shadow huddled deeper within her, a shape of dark regret, tied to her heart with chains of iron. The thin light leaking in at the doorframe caught glimmering in his hair as Aspites pressed himself against her. What if someone should come in? There was no latch on the door. She struggled. Mistaking her fear, he whispered soothing things about her beauty. Each curl of his hair was intricate, textured and individual as a tree. His head seemed a forest, his dark form looming like a distant mountainside. She cried out softly, unable to resist such implacability. Time slid by in the shadows, and Miriamel felt herself drifting away. Aspites once more began to speak. He loved her, her goodness and wit and loveliness. His words, like caresses, were blind but inflaming. She did not care for flattering talk, but felt her resistance melting before his strength and sureness. He cared for her, at least a little. He could hide her away in darkness, pull it around her like a cloak. She would disappear into the deeps of a sheltering forest until the world was right again. The boat swayed gently on the cradling waters. He would protect her from those who would harm her, he said. He would never desert her. She gave herself up to him at last. There was pain, but there were also promises. Miriamel had hoped for nothing more. In a way, it was a lesson the world had already taught her. Awash with strange new feelings, not completely comfortable with any of them, Miriamel sat quietly across the dining table from Aspites, pushing food from one side of her plate to the other. She could not understand why the Earl had forced her to come sit with him in the brightly candlelit room. She could not understand why she was not even slightly in love. A soldier rapped at the doorway, then entered. "We've caught him, Lord," the guardsman said. His satisfaction at having redressed the earlier error of the monk's escape was plain in his voice. Miriamel, seated across the table from Earl Aspites, felt herself stiffen. The guardsman stepped aside, and two of his fellows brought Cadrach in, slumped between them. The monk seemed to be having trouble keeping his head up. Had they beaten him? Miriamel felt a sickening pang of regret. She had half hoped that Cadrach would just vanish, so that she would never have to see him again. It was easier to hate him when he was not around.
"He's drunk, Lord Aspites," the guardsman said. "Stinking. We found him in the Feathered Eel down on the East Dock. He'd already bought the place out on a Perdruanese merchantman, but the fool got pissed and diced it away."
Cadrach looked up blearily, his face slack with despair. Even from across the table, Miriamel could smell the stink of wine.
"Was but to win it back, too. Would have." He shook his head. "Maybe not. Luck's gone bad. Waters are rising."
Aspites rose and strode around the table. He reached out a hand and grasped the monk's chin, pressing with his strong fingers until the flesh bulged between them. He forced Cadrach's pink face upward until their eyes met. The Earl turned to Miriamel.
"Has he tried to do this before, Lady Maria?"
Miriamel nodded helplessly. She wished she was somewhere else.
"More or less."
Aspites returned his attention to the monk.
"What a strange man. Why does he not just leave your father's service, instead of sneaking away like a thief?"
The Earl turned to his squire.
"Are you sure nothing is missing?"
The squire shook his head.
"Nothing, Lord."
Cadrach tried to pull his head free from Aspites' restraining fingers.
had my own gold. Stole nothing. Need to get away.
His eyes fixed uncertainly on Miriamel. His voice took on a note of added desperation.
Dangerous. Storm will get us. Danger!
The Earl of Aedna let go of the monk's chin and wiped his fingers on the tablecloth.
Afraid of a storm? I knew he was not a good sailor, but still, that is very strange. If he were my liegeman, his back would be flayed for this trick. Still, the fellow shall certainly be rewarded for deserting his innocent ward. Neither shall he share a cabin with you any more, Lady Maria.
The Earl's smile was stiffly reassuring.
He may have gone mad, or have conceived some drunken fancy. He says danger, but he is the dangerous one as I see it. He will be confined on the Aedna cloud until I return you to Naben, and we shall then hand him over to Mother Church for discipline.
Confine him? Miriamel asked. That is not...
I may not leave him loose to plague you or worry you, my lady.
The Earl turned to his guardsmen.
The hold will do nicely for him. Give him water and bread, but put the leg irons on him.
Oh, no!
Miriamel was genuinely horrified. However much she despised the monk and his cowardly treachery, the thought of any living thing forced to wear a chain, trapped in a dark hold.
Please, my lady.
Aspites' voice was soft but firm.
I must have order on my ship. I gave you sanctuary, and this man with you. He was your guardian. He betrayed your trust. I still am not sure he has not stolen something from me, or perhaps thinks to sell some intelligence of my mission here in Veneta. No, I am afraid you must leave such men's business to me, pretty Maria.
He waved his hand. Cadrach was led out, staggering between his escorts. Miriamel felt her eyes blurring with tears. They spilled over and she lurched suddenly from her chair.
Excuse me, Earl Aspites,
she mumbled, feeling her way along the table toward the door.
I wish to lie down.
He caught her before she reached the handle, grasping her arm and pulling her smoothly around. The heat of him was very close. She averted her face, conscious of how foolish she must look, eyes red-rimmed and cheeks wet.
Please, my lord, let the monk go.
I know you must feel quite lost, pretty Maria.
Aspites said softly,
do not fear. I promised that I would keep you safe.
She felt herself yielding, becoming pliant. Her strength seemed to be draining away. She was so tired of running and hiding. She had only wanted someone to hold her, to make everything go away. Miriamel shivered and pulled away.
No, it is wrong, wrong. If you do not let him go, I will not stay on this ship.
She pushed out through the door, stumbling blindly. Aspites caught her long before she reached the ladder to the deck. The sea-watcher Ganite was crooning quietly in the darkness above.
You are upset, lady, he said. You must lie down, as you said yourself.
She struggled, but his grip was firm.
I demand that you release me. I do not wish to stay here any longer. I will go ashore and find my own passage from Veneta.
No, my lady, you are not, she gasped.
Let go of my arm, you are hurting me.
Somewhere above, Ganite's song seemed to falter. Aspites leaned forward. His face was very close to hers.
I think there are things that must be made clear between us, he laughed shortly. As a matter of fact, there is much for us to talk about later. You will go to your cabin now. I will finish my supper and then come to you.
I won't go.
You will.
He said it with such quiet certainty that her angry reply caught in her throat as fear clutched her. Aspites pulled her close against him, then turned and forced her along the passageway. The sea-watcher's song had stopped. Now it began again, rising and fading as Ganite murmured to the night and the quiet sea. Chapter 27 The Black Sled.
"They are getting close," Sludig gasped. "If your farewell stone is more than half a league from here, little man, we will have to turn and fight."
Shaking the water from his hood, Binnebik leaned forward across Kantaka's neck. The wolf's tongue lolled and her sides heaved like a blacksmith's bellows. They had been traveling without a stop since daybreak, fleeing through the storm-battered forest.
"I wish I could be telling you that it is near, Sludig. I do not know how much distance remains, but I fear it is most of a day's riding."
The troll stroked Kantaka's sodden fur.
"A brave run, old friend."
She ignored him, absorbed in drinking rainwater from the hollow stump of a tree.
"The giants are hunting us," Sludig said grimly. "They have developed a taste for man meat."
He shook his head.
"When we make our stand at last, some of them will regret that."
Binnebik frowned.
"I have too little size to be a satisfying morsel, so I will not waste their time by being caught. That way, no one will be having regrets."
The Rimmer's man steered his mount over to the stump. Trembling with the cold, parched despite the pelting rain, the horse was heedless of the wolf a hand's breadth away. As their steeds drank, a long rumbling howl lifted above the wind, blood freezingly close.
"Damn me!"
Sludig spat, slapping his palm against his sword hilt.
"They are no farther behind us than they were an hour ago. Do they run fast as horses?"
"Near to it, it is seeming,"
Binnebik said.
"I am thinking we should move deeper into the forest. The thicker trees may slow them."
"You thought getting off the flatlands would slow them too," Sludig said,
reining his reluctant horse away from the hollow stump.
"If we live, then you can be telling me all my incorrectness,"
Binnebik growled. He took a tight grip on the thick fur that mantled Kantaka's neck.
"Now, unless you have been thinking of ways to fly, we should ride."
Another deep, coughing cry came down the wind. Sludig's sword swished from side to side, clearing the brush as they pushed their way down the long wooded slope.
"My blade will be dull when I have greatest need," he complained.
Binnebik, who was leading the string of balking horses, tripped and fell to the muddy earth, then slid a short way down the hillside. The horses milled nervously, confined to the path Sludig had hacked in the swarming undergrowth. Struggling to keep his balance in the mud, the troll got up and tracked down the bridle of the lead horse.
"Kinkeeper of the snows, this storm is never ending."
They took most of the noon hour to make their way down the slope. It appeared that Binnebik's reliance on the forest cover had been at least partially correct. The occasional howls of the Hunin became a little fainter, although they never faded completely. The forest appeared to be growing thinner. The trees were still huge, but not as monumental as their kin that grew closer to Aldeota's center. The trees, alder and oak and tall hemlock, were garlanded in looping vines. The grass and undergrowth grew thick. And even in this queerly cold season, a few yellow and blue wildflowers lifted their heads up from the mud, bobbing beneath the heavy rain. Had it not been for the torrent and the biting wind, this arm of the southern forest would have been a place of rare beauty. They reached the base of the slope at last, and clambered onto a low shelf of stone to scrape the worst of the mud from their boots and clothing before riding once more. Sludig looked back up the hillside, then lifted a pointing finger.
"Elysia's mercy, little man! Look!"
Far up the slope, but still horribly near, a half-dozen white shapes were pushing their way through the foliage, long arms swinging like Nazgadu apes. One lifted its head, the face a black hole against the pale, shaggy fur. A cry of thundering menace rang down the rainy hillside, and Sludig's horse pranced in terror beneath him.
"It is a race," Binnebik said.
His round, brown face had gone quite pale.
for this moment, they are having the best of it.
Kantaka leaped from the shelf of stone, bearing the troll with her. Slúdig and his mount were just behind, leading the other horses. Hooves drummed on the sodden ground. In their haste and ill-suppressed fear, it was some while before they noticed that the ground, while still overgrown, had become unusually flat. They rode beside long empty riverbeds that were now filled anew with rushing, foaming rainwater. Here and there bits of root-gnawed stone stood along the banks, covered with centuries of moss and clinging vines.
"These look like bridges, or the bones of broken buildings," Slúdig called as they rode.
"They are," Binnebeck replied. "It means we are nearing a goal, I hope. This is a place where once the city had a great city."
He leaned forward, hugging Kantaka's neck, as they leaped over a fallen trunk.
"Do you think it will keep the giants at bay?" Slúdig asked. "You said that the diggers did not like the places that the Scythi lived."
"They do not like the forest, and the forest does not like them," the troll said, gentling Kantaka to a halt. "The giant Hunin seemed to be having no such trouble. Perhaps because they are less clever, or less easily frightened, or because they are not digging. I do not know."
He tilted his head, listening. It was hard to hear anything over the relentless hissing patter of rain on leaves, but for the moment the surroundings seemed innocent of danger.
"We will follow the flowing water."
He pointed to the new-grown river hurrying past them, laden with broken branches knocked loose by the storm.
"Seswatra, the Stone of Farewell, is in the valley beside the forest's ending, very close to the city Enki-Shaose, on whose outskirts we are sitting."
He gestured around him with his stubby, mittened hand.
"The river must be flowing down to the valley, so it is sense for us to accompany it."
"Less talking, then, more accompanying," Slúdig said.
"I have been speaking in my day," Binnebeck
said with a certain stiffness,
"to more appreciative ears."
With a shrug, he urged Kantaka forward. They rode past countless remnants of the vast and long untenanted city. Fragments of old walls shimmered in the undergrowth, masses of pale, crumbled bricks, forlorn as lost sheep. In other spots, the foundations of eroded towers lay exposed, curved and empty as ancient jawbones, choked with parasitic moss. The forest had done more than grow into Enki-Shaose. There was virtually nothing left of this city but faint traces. The forest, it seemed, had always been a part of the place, but over the millennia it had become a destroyer, smothering the elaborate stonework in a mass of snaking foliage, enfolding it with roots and branches that patiently unmade even the matchless products of the Scythi builders, returning all to mud and damp sand. There was little inspiration in the crumbling ruins of Enki-Shaose. They seemed only to demonstrate that even the Scythi were bound within the sweep of time, that any work of hands, however exalted, must come at last to ignoble result. Binnebeck and Slúdig found a clearer path running beside the riverbank, and began to make better time, winding their way through the rain-soaked forest. They heard nothing but the sounds of their own passage, and were glad of it. Just as the troll had predicted, the land began to slope more acutely, falling away toward the southwest. Despite its swerving course, the river was moving in that direction as well, the water gaining speed and becoming possessed of what almost seemed like enthusiasm. It positively threw itself at its banks, as if desiring to be everywhere at once. The gouts of water that flew up at obstructions in the riverbed seemed to leap higher than they normally should, as though this watercourse, granted a temporary life, labored to prove to some stern riverine deities its fitness for continued survival.
"Almost out of the forest," Binnebeck panted from Kantaka's bobbing back. "See how the trees are now thinning See? There is light between them ahead.
Indeed, the strand of trees just before them seemed poised at the outermost rim of the earth. Instead of more mottled green foliage, beyond them lay only a wall of fathomless, featureless grey, as though the world's builders had run short of inspiration.
You are right, little man, Sludic said excitedly. Forest's end. Now, if we are within a short ride of this sanctuary of yours, we may shake those horse and giants after all.
Unless my scrolls are none of them correct,
Binnebik replied, as they cantered down the last length of slope.
It is not much distance from forest's edge to the stone of farewell.
He broke off as they reached the final line of trees. Kantaka stopped abruptly, head held low, sniffing the air. Sludig reined up alongside.
Blessed Osiris, the Rimmer's man breathed.
The slope abruptly fell away from them, dropping at a much steeper angle to the wide valley below. Seswadra loomed there, dark and secretive in its shroud of trees, a bony thrust of stone standing far above the valley bottom. Its height was particularly apparent, because it was entirely surrounded by a flat plain of water. The valley was flooded. The stone of farewell, a great fist that seemed to defy the rain-lashed skies, had become an island in a grey and restless sea. Binnebik and Sludig were perched at the forest's edge, only a half league away from their goal, but every cubit of valley floor that lay between was covered by fathoms of floodwater. Even as they stared, a roar echoed through the forest behind them, distant but still frighteningly close. Whatever magic remained to Enki Shaose was too weak to discourage the hungry giants.
Eden, troll, we are caught, like flies in a honey jar, Sludik said,
a tremor of fear creeping into his voice for the first time.
We are backed against the edge of the world. Even if we fight and stave off their first attack, there is no escape.
Binnebik stroked Kantaka's head. The wolf's hackles were up. She whimpered beneath his touch as though she ached to return the challenge, floating down the wind.
Peace, Sludig. We must be thinking.
He turned to squint down the precipitous slope.
I fear you are right about one thing. We are never to be leading horses down this grade.
And what would we do at the bottom in any case? Sludig growled.
Rain dribbled from his beard braids.
That is no mud puddle. This is an ocean. Did your scrolls mention that?
Binnebik waggled his head angrily. His hair hung in his eyes, pasted to his forehead by the rain.
Look up, Sludig! Look up! The sky is full of water, and it is all being dropped down on us, courtesy of our enemy.
He spat in disgust.
This is perhaps become an ocean now, but a week ago it was a valley only, just as the scrolls say.
A worried look crossed his face.
I am wondering if Joshua and the rest were caught in low ground. Daughter of the snows, what a thought! If so, we might as well make our stand in this place, at the world's end, as you call it. Thorn's journey will stop here.
Sludig flung himself down out of the saddle, skidding briefly in the mud. He strode to the lead pack horse and attached the bundled length of the black sword. He hefted it easily, carrying it back to Binnebik in one hand.
Your living sword seems eager for battle, he said sourly. I am half tempted to see what it can do, though it may turn anvil heavy on me in mid-stroke.
No, Binnebik said shortly. My people are not fond of running from a fight, but neither is it time for us to be singing Kruhak death songs and be going happily to glorious defeat. Our quest is not yet given over.
Sludig glowered.
Then what do you say, troll? Shall we fly to that far rock?
The little man hissed in frustration.
No, but first we can look for some other way for getting down.
He gestured at the river thundering past them, which disappeared down the steep wooded slope.
This is not the only waterway. It could be that others will lead us down in a more gradual path to the valley.
And then what? Sludic demanded. Swim?
If necessary.
As Binnebik spoke, the hunting cry of their pursuers rose again, setting the horses to milling and bumping in panic.
Take the horse, Sludic, Binnebik said. There is still chance we may win free.
If so, you are a magical troll indeed. I will name you a Sithi, and you can live forever.
Do not joke here, Binnebik said. Do not mock.
He slid from Kantaka's back, then whispered something in the wolf's ear. With a bound, she was away through the dripping vegetation, trekking eastward along the face of the slope. Sludig and the troll followed as best they could, cutting a trail that the horses could follow. Kantaka, swift as a racing shadow now that the weight of her rider had been lifted from her back, soon found an angled traverse down the cliffside. Despite the sticky, treacherous footing, they were able to make their way slowly down from the high promontory, gradually approaching the lowest edge of the forest, now the shore of a wind-tormented sea. The forest did not come to a sudden ending, but rather disappeared into the rain-rippled water. In some places, the tops of submerged trees still protruded above the surface, little islands of rippling leaves. Naked branches thrust up from the grey flood beside them, like the hands of drowning men. Sludig's horse pulled up just at the water's edge, and the Rimmer's man vaulted down to stand ankle-deep in muddy water.
"I am not sure I see the improvement, troll," he said, surveying the scene. "At least before we were on high ground."
"Cut branches," Binnebik said, clambering through the mud toward him. "Long ones, as many as you can be finding. We will build a raft."
"You are mad," Sludig snapped.
"Perhaps, but you are the strong one, so you must be the cutter. I have rope in the packs for binding the limbs together, and I can do that. Hurry!"
Sludig snorted, but set himself to work. Within moments, his sword was smacking dully against wood.
"If my axes had not been lost on this foolish quest," he panted, "I could build you a whole longhouse in the time it will take me to chop a tree with this poor blade."
Binnebik said nothing, intent on lashing together the rough spars Sludig had already knocked loose. When he had finished with what was available, he went searching for loose wood. He discovered another tributary nearby that dropped down into a narrow gully, before emptying at last into the greater flood. A treasure trove of loose limbs had accumulated in the narrowest spot. Binnebik grabbed them up by the armful, hurrying back and forth between the river and the place where Sludig labored.
"Kantaka cannot swim so far,"
Binnebik grunted as he carried the last useful batch. His eyes had drifted to the distant bulk of Siswadra.
"But I cannot be leaving her to find her own way. There is no way for knowing how long this storm will last. She might never find me again."
He dumped the wood, frowning, then bent to his knots once more, his fingers threading loops of slender cord around the damp wood.
"I cannot make this raft big enough for all three. Not and take that of our belongings which we must be saving. There is no time."
"Then we will take turns being in the water," Sludig said.
He shuddered, staring at the rain-pocked flood.
"Elysium, Mother of God, but I hate the thought of it."
"Clever, Sludig, you are right. We need only make it big enough for one of us to rest while the other two are swimming. And we will go into the water, one after the other."
Binnebik allowed himself a thin smile.
"You Rimmer's men have not lost all your seagoing blood, I see."
As he redoubled his efforts, a furious groan rolled through the woods. They looked up, startled, to see a massive white shape on the promontory only a few short furlongs away.
"God curse them," Sludig moaned,
hacking frenziedly at a slender trunk.
"Why do they pursue us? Do they seek the sword?"
Binnebik shook his head.
"Almost done," he said. "Two more long ones I am needing."
The white figure on the hillside above quickly became several figures. a pack of furious ghosts that raised their long arms against the storming sky. The giants' voices rolled and boomed across the water, as though they threatened not just the puny creatures below, but the Stone of Farewell itself, squatting in serene insolence just beyond their reach.
"Dan,"
Binnabik said, tying the last knot,
"let us move it to the water. If it is not floating, you will have that fight you so desire, Sludig."
It did float, once they had pushed it out past the tangle of drowned undergrowth. Above the storm came the dull crackling of vegetation being smashed aside as the giants came pushing their way down the muddy hillside. Sludig carefully tossed Thorn onto the damp logs. Binnabik hastened back to loot the saddlebags. He dragged one leather sack over unopened and flung it out to Sludig, who stood waist-deep in the murky water.
"Those things are belonging to Simon," the troll called. "They should not be lost."
Sludig shrugged, but pushed the bag on beside the wrapped sword.
"What about the horses?" Sludig shouted.
The howl of their pursuers was growing louder.
"What can we do?" Binnabik said helplessly. "We must set them free."
He drew his knife and slashed the bridle traces from Sludig's mount, then rapidly cut the belly straps of the pack horses as well, so that their burdens slid down onto the muddy turf.
"Hurry, troll," Sludig cried. "They are very close."
Binnabik looked around, his face screwed up in desperate thought. He bent and rifled one last saddlebag, pulling a few articles out before pelting down the slope once more and out into the water.
"Get on," growled Sludig.
"Kantaka,"
Binnabik shouted.
"Come."
The wolf snarled as she turned to face the ruckus of the oncoming giants. The horses were rushing in all directions, whinnying with fright. Suddenly, Sludig's mount broke away through the trees toward the east, and the others swiftly followed. The giants were now quite plain, a few hundred paces up the hill and descending rapidly, their leathery black faces gaping as they howled their hunting song. The Hunin carried great clubs which they wickered back and forth like hollow reeds, smashing a pathway through the knotted trees and shrubbery.
"Kantaka!"
Binnabik shouted, panic in his voice.
"Omo ninit! Oma sosa!"
The wolf turned and bounded toward them, breasting the water, then paddling furiously. Sludig pushed off, taking a few more steps down the submerged slope until his feet no longer touched the bottom. Before they were 30 cubits from the water's edge, Kantaka had caught them. She scrambled over Sludig's back onto the raft, setting it rocking treacherously and almost sinking the Rimmer's man.
"No, Kantaka!"
Binnabik cried.
"Let her be," Sludig gurgled. "Reach down and paddle."
The first giant burst from the forest behind them, howling with rage. His shaggy head twisted from side to side, as if he sought some other angle to head off his prey's escape. When none was apparent, he strode forward into the water. He went several steps before he suddenly fell forward with a splash, disappearing from view for a moment beneath the water. When he surfaced an instant later, he was thrashing madly, dirty white fur festooned with branches. He raised his chin and barked thunderously at the storm, as though demanding help. His fellows swarmed on the shore behind him, hooting and groaning with frustrated bloodlust. The first giant swam awkwardly and unhappily back to the shallows. He stood up, streaming with water, and reached down an ape-like arm to pull loose a massive tree limb, thick as a man's leg. Grunting, he flung it through the air. The limb hit the water beside the raft with a tremendous splash, tearing Sludig's cheek with a jutting branch and nearly upsetting the crude boat. Stunned, Sludig foundered. Binnabik disentangled himself from Kantaka and leaned forward, hooking the toes of his boots into gaps between the beams of the pitching raft. The little man clutched the Rimmer's man's wrist with both hands until Sludig recovered. The giants hurled more missiles, but none came as close as the first. Their thwarted bellows seemed to rumble across all the flooded valley. Cursing giants and rafts equally, Sludig pushed off with his long Canuck spear, until they at last floated free of clinging branches. He began to kick, pushing the raft and its unlikely cargo out across the chill grey water toward the shadowy stone. Aelair rode east from his ancestral home of Nad Mullach, beneath night skies a flicker with strange lights. The countryside around his captured stronghold had proved less hospitable than he had hoped. Many of his people had already been driven away by the misfortunes of war and the terrible weather, and those who remained were reluctant to open their doors to a stranger, even if that stranger claimed to be the ruling count. Occupied Hernestia was a land held prisoner more by fear than by enemy soldiers. Few others were abroad by night, which was when Eale did most of his travelling. Even Skarli of Coldstriker's men, despite their conqueror's crowns, seemed reluctant to stir forth, as if taking on the character of those they had conquered. In this grim summer of snow and restless spirits, even the war's victors bowed before a greater power. Eale was more than ever certain that he must find Joshua, if the prince still lived. Maegwin might have sent him on this quest because of some odd or spiteful notion. But now it seemed laughably apparent that the north of Austin Ard had fallen beneath a shadow of more than human origin, and that the riddle of the sword Brightnail might very well have something to do with it. Why else would the gods have arranged that Eale should be in that monstrously strange city beneath the ground, or that he should meet its even stranger denizens? The Count of Nad Mulloch was a pragmatist by nature. His long years of service to the king had hardened his heart to fantasy. But at the same time, his experience of diplomacy had also made him mistrustful of excessive coincidence. To suggest that there was no overriding supernatural element to the summer that was winter, the reappearance of creatures out of legend, and the sudden importance of forgotten but near-mythical swords, was to close one's eyes to a reality as plain as the mountains and the seas. Also, despite all his endless days in the court of Erkinland, Navan and Perdruin, and for all his cautious words to Maegwin, Eale was a Hernestia man. More than any other mortal man, the Hernestiri remembered. As Eale rode into Erkinland, across bleak Utangit, toward the battle site of Ach Samrath, the storm grew stronger. The snow, however unseasonable, had until now fallen only moderately, as it might in the early days of Novander. Now the winds were rising, changing the flat countryside into a flurrying landscape of white nothingness. The cold was so fierce that he was forced to abandon night riding altogether for a few days, but he worried little about being recognized. The roads and countryside were all but deserted, even at grey, blustery noon. He noted with sour satisfaction that Utanyit, the earldom of Guthwulf, one of High King Elias' favourites, was as storm-wounded as any of Hernestia. There was some justice, after all. Trekking endlessly through white emptiness, he found himself thinking often of his people left behind, but especially of Maegwin. Although in some ways she had become almost as wild and intractable as a beast since the death of her father and brother, he had always felt great affection toward her. That was not yet gone. But it was hard not to feel betrayed by her treatment of him, no matter how well he thought he understood its cause. Still, he could not bring himself to hate her. He had been a special friend to her since she had been a little girl, making a point of speaking with her whenever he was at court, letting her show him the Teig's gardens, as well as the pigs and chickens to which she gave names, and which she treated with the same annoyed fondness a mother might show her reckless children. As she grew, becoming as tall as a man, but nonetheless comely for it, Eale had watched her also become steadily more reserved, only occasionally showing the flashes of girlishness which had so delighted him before. She seemed to turn inward, like a rose bush bulked by an overhanging roof that coiled in on itself until its own thorns rubbed its stems raw. She still reserved special attention for Eale, but that attention was more and more confusing, more and more made up of awkward silences and her angry self-recriminations. For a while he had thought she cared for him as more than just a friend of her family and distant kinsmen. He had wondered whether two such solitary folk could ever find their way together. Eale, for all his easy speech and cleverness, had always felt that the best part of himself was hidden far beneath the surface, just as his quiet hillkeeper Nad Mullach stood remote from the bustle of the Teig. But even as he had quietly begun to think in earnest about Maegwin, even as his admiration for her honesty and for her impatience with nonsense had begun to ripen into something deeper, she had turned cold to him. She seemed to have decided that Eile was only another of the legion of idlers and flatterers that surrounded King Luth. One long afternoon in eastern Utanit, as the snow stung his face, and he wandered far away in thought, he suddenly wondered, was I wrong? Did she care for me all that time? It was a horrifying thought, because it suddenly turned the world he knew on its head, and gave vastly different meaning to everything that had transpired between them since Maegwin had become a woman. Have I been blind? But if that were so, why should she act so backwardly to me? Have I not always treated her with respect and kindness? After turning the idea over in his head for a long hour, he put it away again. It was too uncomfortable to consider any longer, here in the middle of nowhere, with months or more between now and when he could see her again. And she had sent him away in anger, had she not? The wind picked restlessly at the unsettled snow. He rode past Ach Samrath on a morning when the storm had abated somewhat, stopping his horse on a rise above the ancient battlefield where Prince Sinach and 10,000 of his Hernesteermen had been destroyed by Fingal of Rimmersgard, and the treachery of the Thrything's lord Neonort. As on the few other occasions he had visited this site, Eile felt a shiver climb through him as he looked down at the great flat field. But this time, it was not prompted by the grisly past. With the freezing wind on his face and the cold, blank face of the north staring down at him, he suddenly realized that by the time this new and greater war had ended, whether on a battlefield or beneath a remorseless tide of black winter, it might be in a frenzy of death that would make Ach Samrath seem a petty dispute. He rode on, his anger turning to ice inside him. Who had set this great thing in motion? Who had set this evil wheel to turning? Had it been Elias or his pet serpent Priorates? If so, there should be a special hell prepared for them. Eile only hoped he would be around to see them sent there. Maybe on the end of Prester John's Brightnail, if the subterranean Dwaros spoke rightly. As Eile came to the edge of Aldeota, he reverted once more to night riding. The storm's teeth seemed a little duller here in Elias' realm, only a dozen leagues from the outskirts of Urchester, and he also thought it safer not to count on the infrequency of meeting other travellers any longer. Here, that infrequent other traveller was likely to be one of the High King's Erkingard. Beneath the shadow of the great wood, the silent, snow-blanketed farmlands seemed to wait apprehensively for whatever might come next, as though this storm were only the precursor of some darker deed. Eile knew that these were his own feelings, but also felt strongly that they were not his alone. A sense of dread hung over Erkinland, filling the air like a terrible, will-sapping fog. The few lone farmers and woodsmen whose wagons he saw on the road did not respond to his greetings, except to make the sign of the tree as they passed him on the moonless roads, as though Eile might be some demon or walking dead man. But their torches revealed that it was their own faces that had gone slack and pale as the masks of corpses, as though the fearful winds and constant snow had leached the very life from them. He approached Thistleborg. The great hill stood only a few leagues from Urchester's gates, and was the closest he would come to the Hayholt, from which on certain of the blackest nights he could almost feel Elias' sleepless malice burning like a torch in a high tower. It was only the High King, he reminded himself, a mortal man whom he had once respected, although never liked. Whatever mad plans Elias had made, whatever dreadful bargains, he was still only a man. Thistleborg's peak seemed to flicker as the count drew nearer, as though high on the hill crest great watchfires burned. Aelair wondered if Elias had made it a guard post, but could think of no reason why. Did the High King fear some invasion from the ancient forest, the Aldeota? It mattered little in any case. Aelair was firmly resolved to circle Thistleborg on the far side from Urchester, and felt no urge whatsoever to investigate the mysterious lights. The Black Hill had an evil reputation that extended back far beyond the days of even Elias' father, King John. Stories about Thistleborg were many, none of them pleasant to hear. In such days as these, Aelair wished he could avoid coming any closer than a league or so, but the forest, another dubious place to be at night, and the walls of Urchester prevented such a judiciously wide swing. He had just started around the north of the hill, his mount picking its way through the ever-thickening trees of Aldeota's fringe, when he felt a wave of fear sweep over him that was unlike anything he had ever experienced. His heart hammered, and a chill sweat broke out on his face, then turned almost immediately to fragile ice. Aelair felt like a field mouse that, too late for escape, suddenly perceived the stooping hawk. He had to restrain himself from digging in his spurs and riding madly in whatever direction he was already facing. He whirled, looking wildly for whatever might be the cause of such dreadful terror, but could see nothing. At last he slapped his horse's flank and rode a short distance farther into the shielding trees. Whatever had caused him to feel this way, it seemed a product of the unprotected snows rather than the shadowy forest. The storm was much less fierce here, as it had been since he had entered Aldeota's lee, but for a sprinkling of snow the sky was clear. A vast yellow moon hung in the eastern sky, turning all the landscape to a sickly shade of bone. The Count of Nad Mullach looked up at the looming bulk of Thistleborg, wondering if that could be the source of his sudden fright, but could see or hear nothing extraordinary. A part of him wondered if he had not been riding too long alone with his morbid thoughts, but that part was easily ignored. Aelair was a Hernesteer man. Hernesteri remembered. A thin sound, an unidentifiable but persistent scraping, began to make itself heard. He looked down from secretive Thistleborg and turned his gaze westward across the snows, toward the direction from which he had come. Something was moving slowly across the white plain. The chill of fear grew deeper, spreading through him like a prickling frost. As his horse moved uncomfortably, Aelair put a trembling hand on its neck. The beast, as if it perceived his own terror, suddenly became very still. Their twin plumes of breath were the only moving things in the shadow of the trees. The scraping grew louder. Aelair could now see the shapes moving closer over the snows, a mass of luminous white followed by a lump of blackness. Then, with the stark unreality of a nightmare, the gleaming shapes came clear. It was a team of white goats, shaggy pelts glowing as though with captured moonlight. Their eyes were red as embers, and their heads seemed somehow gravely wrong. When he thought of it afterward, he could never say why, except that the shapes of their hairless muzzles seemed to suggest some kind of unpleasant intelligence. The goats, nine in all, drew behind them a great black sled. It was the sound of the runners crunching through the snow that he had heard. Seated on the sled was a hooded figure that even across a distance of some 100 cubits seemed too large. Several other smaller, black-robed figures marched solemnly alongside, hoods tilted downward, like monks in meditation. An almost uncontrollable horror ran up Aeolair's spine. His horse had turned to stone beneath him, as if fright had stopped its heart and left it dead upon its feet. The ghastly procession scraped past, agonizingly slow, silent, but for the noise of the sled. Just as the robed figures were about to vanish into the darkness of Thistleborg's lowest slopes, one of the hooded shapes turned, showing Aelair what he fancied was a flash of skeletal white face, black holes that might have been eyes. the part of his shrieking thoughts that was still coherent, thanked the gods of his and all other peoples for the shadows of the forest's fringe. The hooded eyes turned away at last. The sled and its escort vanished into the snowy woods of Thistleborg. Eyle stood a long time, allowing himself to tremble, but did not move from the spot until he was sure it was safe. His teeth had been so tightly clenched that his jaws ached. He felt as though he had been stripped raw and tumbled down a long black hole. When he dared to move at last, he threw himself onto his horse's neck and galloped away into the east as swiftly as he could. His mount, eager as he, needed no spurs, no crop. They whirled away in a cloud of snow. As Eyle fled Thistleborg and its mysteries, running eastward beneath the mocking moon, he knew that everything he had feared was true, and that there were things in the world that were worse even than his fears. Ingen Jegger stood beneath the spreading arms of a black hemlock, unmindful of the bitter wind or the frost growing in his close-cropped beard. But for the impatient life in his pale blue eyes, he might have been a luckless traveller, frozen to death, waiting for a morning's warmth that came too late. The huge white hound, crouching in the snow at his feet, stirred, then made an inquiring sound, like the scrape of rusty hinges.
"Hungry, Nikwa?" A look almost of fondness ran across Ingen's taut features. "Quiet. Soon. You will have your fill."
Motionless, Ingen watched and listened, sifting the night like a whiskered beast of prey. The moon crept from one gap in the overhanging trees to another. The forest, but for the wind, was silent. Ah! Satisfied, he took a few steps and shook the snow from his cloak.
"Now, Nikwa, call your brothers and sisters. Howl up the storm spike pack. It is time for the last chase."
Nikwa leaped up, quivering with excitement. As if it had understood Ingen's every word, the great hound trotted out into the middle of the clearing before settling back on its haunches and lifting its snout to the sky. Powerful throat muscles convulsed, and a coughing howl shattered the night. Even as the first echoes died, Nikwa's strident voice burst out again, hacking and baying. The very branches of the trees trembled. They waited, Ingen's gloved hand resting on the dog's wide head. Time passed. Nikwa's cloudy white eyes gleamed as the moon slid along between the trees. At last, as night's coldest hour crept in, the faint cries of hounds came sweeping down the wind. The belling rose until it filled the forest. A host of white shapes appeared from the darkness, filtering into the clearing like four-legged ghosts. The stormspike hounds wove in and out among the tree roots, narrow, shark-like heads questing and sniffing. Starlight gleamed on muzzles smeared with blood and spittle. Nikwa went among them, nipping, snarling, until at last the whole pack crouched or lay in the snow around Ingen Jegger, red tongues lolling. The Queen's huntsman calmly looked over his strange congregation, then picked his snarling, dog-faced helm from the ground.
"Too long have you been roaming free," he hissed, "harrying the forest fringes, stealing babies like kennel cubs, running down foolish travellers for the joy of the chase. Now, your master's come back. Now, you must do what you were bred to do."
The milky eyes followed him as he moved to his horse, which waited with supernatural patience beneath the hemlock.
"But this time, I will lead, not you. It is a strange chase, and Ingen alone has been taught the scent."
He pulled himself up into the saddle.
"Run silently."
He He lowered the helmet onto his head, so that Hound looked at Hound's.
We take death to the Queen's enemies.
A low growling rose from the dogs as they rose and came together, sliding against one another, snapping at each other's faces and tails in fierce anticipation. Ingen spurred his horse forward, then turned.
Follow, he cried. Follow to death and blood.
He passed swiftly from the clearing. The pack ran after, voiceless now, silent and white as snowfall. Huddled deep in his cloak, Isgrimnor sat in the bow of the small boat and watched stubby Sinatris rowing and sniffling. The Duke wore a fixed expression of grim preoccupation, in part because he found the boatman's company extremely unrewarding, but mostly because he himself hated boats, especially small boats like the one on which he was now trapped. Sinatris had spoken truthfully about one thing anyway. This was no time to be on the water. A great storm was flailing the entire length of the coast. The choppy water of Firanos Bay constantly threatened to swamp them, and Sinatris had not stopped moaning since their hull had first touched the water a week before, some 30 leagues northward. The Duke had to admit that Sinatris was a talented boatman, if only in the defense of his own life. The Nabon man had handled his craft well under terrible conditions. If only he would stop sniveling. Isgrimnor was no happier about the conditions for their journey than Sinatris was, but he would be damned to the blackest circle of hell before he made a fool out of himself by showing it.
How far to Quernetupur?
He shouted over the noise of wind and waves.
Half a day, Master Monk,
Sinatris called back, eyes red and streaming.
We will stop soon to sleep. Then we can be there by midday tomorrow.
Sleep? Isgrimnor roared. Are you mad? It is not even dark yet. Besides, you'll only try to sneak away again. And this time I will not be so merciful. If you cease your self-pitying nonsense and work, you can sleep in a bed tonight.
Please, holy brother, Sinatris almost shrieked. Do not force me to row in darkness. We will run onto the rocks. Our only beds will be down among the kilpa.
Don't hand that superstitious nonsense to me. I'm paying you well, and I'm in a hurry. If you are too weak or sore, let me take those paddles for a while.
The oarsman, wet and cold, still managed a convincing look of wounded pride.
You would have us under the water in a moment. No, you cruel monk. If Sinatris must die, let it be with his oars in his hand. As befits a Firanos boatman, if Sinatris must be torn from his home and the bosom of his family and sacrificed to the whims of a monster in the robes of a priest, if he must die, let it be as a guildman.
Isgrimnor groaned.
Let it be with his mouth closed for a change, and keep paddling.
Rowing,
Sinatris replied frostily, then burst into tears once more. It was past midnight when the first stilt houses of Quernetupul came into view. Sinatris, whose complaining had faded at last to a low, self-pitying murmur, nosed the boat into the great network of canals. Isgrimnor, who had briefly fallen asleep, rubbed his eyes and craned his head, looking around. Quernetupul's ramshackle warehouses and inns were all dusted with a thin coating of snow.
If I doubted that the world had gone topsy-turvy, Isgrimnor thought bemusedly, here is all the proof I need. A Rimmer's man taking a leaky boat to sea in a storm, and snow in the Southland in high summer. Can any doubt the world has run mad?
Madness. He remembered the hideous death of the lector, and felt his stomach gurgle. Madness, or something else. It was a strange coincidence that Priorates and Benegaris should both be in the house of Mother Church on such a dreadful night. Only a stroke of rare luck had brought Isgrimnor to Dunedin, in time to hear the priest's last words. and perhaps to salvage something from this grim pass. He had escaped from the Sankelenidonitis only moments before Benigaris, Duke of Naban, had ordered his guardsmen to bar all doors. Escrimnor could not have afforded capture. Even if he had not been immediately recognized, his story would not have held up long. Clafmancer Eve, the night of the Lector's murder, had been a bad night to be an unfamiliar guest at the St. Helen.
"Do you know of a place here called Pelipus Bowl?" he asked aloud. "I think it is an inn or a hostel."
"I have never heard of the place, Master Monk," Sinatris said gravely. "It sounds like a low establishment, one in which Sinatris would not be seen."
Now that they had reached the relatively still waters of the canals, the boatman had reassumed much of his dignity. Escrimnor decided he liked him better when he snivelled.
"By the tree, we will never find it at night. Take me to some inn, you know, then. I must get something under my belt."
Sinatris steered the little craft down a series of crisscrossing canals to the city's tavern district. Things seemed quite lively here, despite the late hour. The boardwalks lined with garish cloth lanterns that swung in the wind. The alleyways full of drunken revelers.
"This is a fine inn, holy brother," Sinatris said as they glided to a stop at the dock stairs of a well-lit establishment. "There is wine to be had, and food."
Sinatris, feeling bold now that their journey had ended safely, gave Escrimnor a chummy, gap-toothed smile.
"And women, too."
His smile grew uncertain as he surveyed Escrimnor's face.
"Or boys, if that is more to your liking."
The Duke forced a great hiss of air between his teeth. He reached into his cloak and pulled out a gold imperator, then placed it gently on the rowing bench beside Sinatris' skinny leg. Escrimnor next moved to the bottommost stair.
"There is your thievish payment, as I promised. Now, I have a suggestion for how you might spend your evening."
Sinatris looked up warily.
"Yes?"
Escrimnor drew down his eyebrows in a horrible frown.
"Spend it doing your very best to make sure that I do not see you again. Because if I do..."
He lifted his hairy fist.
"I will roll your eyeballs around in your pointy head. Understood?"
Sinatris dropped his oar blades and backed water hastily, so that Escrimnor had to quickly swing his other foot up onto the stairs.
"So this is how you monks treat Sinatris, after all his favors?"
the boatman said indignantly, puffing up his thin chest like a courting pigeon.
"No wonder the church is in bad repute. You bearded barbarian!"
He splashed off into the darkened canal. Escrimnor laughed harshly, then stumped up the stairs to the inn. After several fitful nights in the grasslands, nights in which he had been forced to keep a careful watch on the treacherous Sinatris, who had several times tried to slip away and leave Escrimnor stranded on the bleak, windswept coast of Faranos Bay, the Duke of Elvritzhala took his sleep in full measure. He remained in bed until the sun was high in the sky, then broke his fast with a manly portion of bread and honey, accompanied by a stoup of ale. It was nearly noontide before he obtained directions to Palipa's Bowl from the innkeeper and was out on the rainy canals once more. His boatman this time was a Rannerman, who, despite the bitter wind, wore only a loincloth and a broad-brimmed hat with a red, drizzle-soaked feather drooping from the band. The boatman's sullen silence was a pleasant change from the ceaseless carping of Sinatris. Escrimnor settled back to fondle his new-sprouted beard and enjoy the sodden sights of Quenetupul, a city he had not visited for many years. The storm had obviously cast a pall over the trading city. Unless things had changed greatly since his last sojourn, there should be many more boats out on the water at midday, many more folk wandering Quenetupul's exotic byways. Those who were about seemed to be hurrying to their destinations. Even the ritual cries of greeting and challenge that rang between canal boats seemed unusually muted. Like insects, the residents seemed chilled almost to immobility by the snow that melted in patches on their wooden walkways, and the windborne sleet that stung exposed limbs and filled the canals with circular ripples. Here and there among the sparse crowds, Escrimnor saw small gatherings of fire dancers, the religious maniacs who had gained their notoriety by self-immolation. They had become a familiar sight to the Duke since he had first reached Naban. These wild-eyed penitents, uncaring of the cold, stood on the walkways near busy canal intersections and shouted the praises of their dark master, the Storm King. Escrimnor wondered where they had heard that name. He had never heard it spoken south of the Frostmarch before, even in a children's bogey story. It was no coincidence, he knew, but he could not help musing on whether these robed lunatics were the pawns of someone like Priorates, or true visionaries. If the latter was the case, then the end they foresaw might be real. Escrimnor shuddered at this thought and made the sign of the tree on his breast. Black times these were. For all their shouting, though, the fire dancers did not seem to be engaging in their familiar trick of setting themselves aflame. The Duke smiled sourly. Perhaps it was a little too damp today. The boatman stopped at last before an unprepossessing structure in the warehouse district, far from the centers of commerce. When Escrimnor had paid him, the little dark man reached up with his gaff hook and pulled down the rope ladder from the dock. The Duke was scarcely halfway up the swinging ladder before the boatman had turned around and was coasting out of sight down a side canal. Huffing and cursing his fat belly, Escrimnor at last made his way up onto the more trustworthy footing of the dock. He rapped at the weather-worn door, then waited a long time in the freezing rain without answer, growing increasingly cross. At last, the door swung open, revealing a frowning woman of middle age.
"I don't know where the half-wit is," she told Escrimnor, as though he had asked. "It's not enough that I have to do every other lick of work here, but now I have to answer the door as well."
For a moment, the Duke was so taken aback that he almost apologized. He struggled with his impulse towards chivalry.
"I want a room," he said at last.
"Well, come in then,"
the woman said doubtfully, opening the door wider. Beyond lay a makeshift boathouse that stank of tar and old fish. A couple of hulls were laid out like casualties of battle. In the corner, a brown arm protruded from a huddle of blankets. For a moment, Escrimnor thought it was a corpse that had been carelessly thrown into the doorway. When the arm moved, pulling the blankets closer, he realized that it was only someone sleeping. He had a sudden premonition that he might not find the accommodations here up to the best standards, but he forced the thought down.
"You're getting fussy, old man," he chided himself. "On the battlefield, you've slept in mud and blood and the nests of biting flies."
He had a mission, he reminded himself. His own comfort was secondary.
"By the way,"
he called after the innkeeper, whose brisk steps had taken her almost the entire length of the dooryard,
"I'm looking for someone."
Suddenly he could not recall the name Dinevan had told him. He stopped, running his fingers through his damp beard. Then remembered.
"Tiamak. I'm looking for Tiamak."
When the woman turned, her sour expression had been supplanted by a look of greedy pleasure.
"You," she said. "You're the one with the gold."
She opened her arms wide as though to embrace him. Despite the dozen cubits that separated them, the Duke took a step backward, repelled. The bundle of blankets in the corner began to wiggle like a nest of piglets, then fell away. A small and very thin Ranaman sat up, eyes still half closed from sleep.
"I am Tiamak," he said, trying to stifle a yawn. As he surveyed Escrimnor, the marshman's face seemed to show disappointment.
as though he had expected something better. The Duke felt his annoyance returning. Were all these people mad? Who did they think he was, or expect him to be?
"I bring you tidings,"
Iskrimnor said stiffly, uncertain of how to proceed.
"But we should talk in private."
"I will show you to your room," the woman said hastily. "The finest in the house, and the little brown gentleman, another honored guest, can join you there."
Iskrimnor had just turned back to Tiamak, who seemed to be dressing awkwardly beneath the blankets, when the inside door of the inn thumped open, and a horde of children barged through, whooping like Thrithings men at war. They were pursued by a tall, white-haired old man, who grinned from ear to ear as he pretended to stalk them. They fled him with shrieks of delight, and crashed through the door leading out to the dock. Before he could pursue them any further, the landlady stepped before him, fists on hips.
"Damn you for a simple ass, Gielio! You are here to answer the door!"
The old man, though considerably taller, cowered before her, as though expecting a blow.
"I know you are addled-pated, but you are not deaf. Did you not hear someone knocking at the door?"
The old man moaned wordlessly. The landlady turned from him in disgust.
"He's as stupid as a stone,"
she began, then broke off, staring as Iskrimnor dropped to his knees. The Duke felt the world tilt, as though giant hands had lifted it. It took long moments before he could speak, moments in which the landlady, the little Rana man, and the old doorkeeper looked at him with varying degrees of uneasy fascination. When Iskrimnor spoke, it was to the old man.
"My lord Camaris," he said, and felt his voice catch in his throat. The world had gone mad. Now the dead lived again. "Merciful Elysia, Camaris, do you not remember me? I am Iskrimnor. We fought for Prester John together. We were friends. Ah, God, you live. How can that be?"
He reached his hand out to the old man, who took it as a child might take something shiny or colorful offered by a stranger. The old man's grip was calloused, with a great strength that could be felt even as his hand lay flaccidly in Iskrimnor's own. His handsome face showed only smiling incomprehension.
"What are you saying?" the landlady said crossly. "That's old Gielio, the doorkeeper. Been here for years. He's a simpleton."
"Camaris,"
Iskrimnor breathed as he pressed the old man's hand to his cheek, wetting it with tears. He could scarcely speak.
"Oh, my good lord, you live."
Chapter 28. Sparks. Despite the unceasing loveliness of Zhao E. Tenukai, or perhaps because of it, Simon was bored. He was also unutterably lonely. His imprisonment was a strange thing. The Scythi did not hinder him, but other than Jiriki and Aditu, they continued to show no interest in him, either. Like a queen's lapdog, he was well-fed and well-cared for, allowed to roam wherever he could go, but only because the outside world was beyond his reach. Like a prize pet, he amused his masters, but was not taken seriously. When he spoke to them, they responded politely in Simon's own westerling speech, but among themselves they spoke the liquid Scythi tongue. Only a few recognizable words ever reached his ear, but whole rivers of incomprehensible talk flowed around him. The suspicion that they might be discussing him in their private conversations infuriated him. The possibility that they might not, that they might never think of him except when in his presence, was somehow even worse. It made him feel insubstantial as a ghost. Since his interview with Amaterasu, the days had begun to flit past even more rapidly. As he lay in his blankets one night, he realized he could no longer say for certain how long he had been among the Scythi. Aditu, when asked, claimed not to remember. Simon took the same question to Jariki, who fixed him with a look of great pity, and asked whether he truly wished to count the days. Chilled by the implication, Simon demanded the truth. Jariki told him that a little over a month had passed. That had been some days ago. The nights were the most difficult. In his nest of blankets in Jariki's house, or roaming the soft, damp grass beneath strange stars, Simon tormented himself with impossible plans for escape, plans that even he knew were as impractical as they were desperate. He became more and more morose. He knew Jariki was worried for him, and even Aditu's quicksilver laugh seemed forced. Simon knew that he was speaking constantly of his misery, but could not hide it. Moreover, he did not want to hide it. Whose fault was it that he was trapped here? They had saved his life, of course. Would it truly have been better to die by freezing or slow starvation, he chided himself, rather than living as a pampered, if restricted, guest in the most wonderful city in Ostenard? But even though such ingratitude might be shameful, he still could not reconcile himself to his blissful prison. Every day was much the same. He wandered through the forest alone, or threw stones into the countless streams and rivers, and thought of his friends. In the sheltering summer of Zhao E Tanokai, it was hard to imagine how they must all be suffering in the dreadful winter outside. Where was Benabik, Miriam Mal, Prince Joshua? Did they even live? Had they fallen beneath the black storm, or did they still struggle? Growing ever more frantic, he begged Jariki to let him speak to Amarasu again, to plead for her help in setting him free. But Jariki declined.
It is not my place to instruct First Grandmother. She will act in her own time, when she has thought carefully. I am sorry, Seoman, but these matters are too important to hurry.
Hurry? Simon raged. By the time anyone does anything in this place, I will be dead.
But Jariki, although visibly saddened, remained adamant. Balked at every turn, Simon's anxiousness began to turn to anger. The reserved Scythi came to seem smug and self-righteous beyond enduring. While Simon's friends were fighting and dying, engaged in a dreadful losing battle with the Storm King as well as with Elias, these foolish creatures wandered through their sunlit forest, singing and contemplating the trees. And who was the Storm King anyway but a Scythi? No wonder that his fellows were keeping Simon prisoned, while the world outside withered before Inaluki's cold wrath. So the days spun by, each more and more like its predecessor, each increasing Simon's disaffection. He ceased taking his evening meal with Jariki, preferring a more solitary appreciation of the songs of crickets and nightingales. Resentful of Aditu's playfulness, he began to avoid her. He was sick of being teased and fondled. He meant no more to her, he knew, than the lapdog did to the queen. He would have no more. If he must be a prisoner, he would act like one. Jariki found him sitting in a copse of large trees, sullen and prickly as a hedgehog. The bees were mumbling in the clover, and the sun streamed down through the needles, cross-hatching the ground with slivers of light. Simon was chewing on a piece of bark.
Seoman, the prince said, may I speak with you?
Simon frowned. He had learned that Scythi, unlike mortals, would actually go away if permission was not given. Jariki's folk had a deep respect for privacy.
I suppose so, Simon said at last. I would like you to come with me, Jariki said. We will go to the Yasara.
Simon felt a quickening of hope, but it was a painful thing.
Why? I do not know. I only know that we are all asked to come, all who live in Zhao E Tanokai. Since you live here now, I think it fitting that you come.
Simon's hopes sank. They did not ask for me. For a moment, He had envisioned how it would be. Shemar Nari and Lycimaia apologizing for their mistake, sending him back to his own kind, bearing presents, laden as well with the wisdom to help Joshua and the others. Another mooncalf daydream. Hadn't he grown out of them yet?
"I don't want to go," he said at last.
Jariki squatted beside him, poised as gracefully as a hunting bird upon a branch.
"I wish that you would, Seoman," he said at last. "I cannot force you, and I will not plead, but Amarasu will be there. It is rare indeed for her to ask to speak to our people, except when it is the day of year dancing."
Simon felt his interest quicken. Perhaps Amarasu was going to speak on his behalf, order them to let him go. But if that was the case, why hadn't he been asked to come? He feigned indifference. Whatever else occurred, he was steadily learning Scythi ways.
"There you go about year dancing again, Jariki," he said. "But you have never told me what it means. I saw the year dancing grove, you know."
Jariki appeared to be suppressing a smile.
"Not very closely, I think. But come, Seoman, you're playing a game. Some other time I will tell you what I can of the responsibilities of our family's house. But now I must go. You too, if you plan to accompany me."
Simon tossed the piece of chewed-upon bark over his shoulder.
"I'll go if I can sit near the door, and if I don't have to speak."
"You can sit wherever you please, Snorlock. You are a prisoner, perhaps, but an honored one. My people are trying to make your time here endurable. As to the rest, I have no say over what you may be asked. Come. You are almost grown, man-child. Do not be afraid to stand for yourself."
Simon frowned, considering.
"Lead on, then," he said.
They stopped before the doorway of the great living tent. The butterflies were agitated, fluttering their spangled wings so that shifting patterns, colored shadow, rippled across the face of the Yasara, like wind through a field of wheat. The papery rustle of their gentle commingling filled the whole glen. Suddenly unwilling to proceed through the door, Simon pulled back, shaking himself free of Jariki's companionable arm.
"I don't want to hear anything bad," he said.
There was a cold heaviness in the pit of his stomach, the same as he had felt when he expected punishment from Rachel or the Master of Scullions.
"I don't want to be shouted at."
Jariki looked at him quizzically.
"No one will shout, Seoman. That is not our way, we Sedeia. This may be nothing to do with you at all."
Simon shook his head, embarrassed.
"Sorry."
"Of course." He took a deep breath and shrugged nervously, then waited until Jariki gently took his arm once more and steered him toward the Yasara's rose-entwined doorway. A thousand butterfly wings hissed like a dry wind as Simon and his companion stepped through into the vast bowl of multi-hued light. Lycimaia and Shemar Nari, as before, were seated at the center of the room on low couches near the jutting, vindically colorful manor, plumed like rare birds. Still, the golden-eyed Scythi seemed unusually reserved, even by the standards of a retiring folk. Many eyes had turned towards Simon and Jariki upon their entrance, but no one gaze had lingered long. The attention of all assembled seemed fixed on the three figures at the center of the vast tree chamber. Glad of the anonymity, Simon chose a place on the outskirts of the silent crowd for Jariki and himself to sit. He did not see Aditu anywhere, but he knew she would be hard to pick out in the midst of such an array. For a long time there was no movement or speech, although it seemed to Simon that there were hidden currents moving just beneath his own understanding, subtle communications shared by everyone in the room but him. Still, He was not so insensitive that he failed to perceive the tension of the quiet Scythi, the clear sense of uneasy anticipation. There was a sharpness to the air, as before a lightning storm. He had begun to wonder if they would go on this way all afternoon, like a group of cat rivals gathered on a wall, silently staring each other down. When at last Shimon Nari rose and began to speak. This time, the master of Zhao E Tanukai did not bother with Simon's own westerling tongue, but used the musical Scythi speech. He spoke for some while, accompanying his soliloquy with graceful hand gestures, the sleeves of his pale yellow robe fluttering as he emphasized his words. To Simon, it was only confusion piled atop incomprehensibility.
"My father speaks of Amaterasu and asks us to listen to her," Jariki whispered, translating.
Simon was dubious. Shima Onari seemed to have spoken a very long time just to say that. He glanced around the Yasura at the somber, cat-eyed faces. Whatever Jiriki's father was saying, he had the undivided and almost frighteningly complete attention of his people. When Shima Onari concluded, Likimea rose, and all eyes then turned to her. She too spoke for a long time in the language of the Sedeia.
"She says Amaterasu is very wise," explained Jiriki.
Simon frowned. When Likimea finished, a great gentle sigh arose, as though all assembled had released their breath at once. Simon let out his own quiet sigh, one of relief. As the incomprehensible babble of Scythi tongue went on, he had been finding it harder and harder to concentrate. Even the butterflies were moving restlessly above, the colorful sun patterns made by their wings swimming back and forth across the great chamber. At last, Amaterasu stood. She seemed much less frail than she had in her house. Simon had thought her then like a martyred saint. But now he saw in her a touch of the angelic, a power that smoldered low but which could burst out into pure white light. Her long hair moved in a breeze that might have come from the careful movement of a million wings.
"I see that the mortal child is here," she said. "So I will speak in a way that he can understand. As much of what I say came from him. He has a right to hear."
Several Scythi turned their heads to gaze impassively at Simon. Caught by surprise, he dropped his chin and looked down at his chest, until they had turned away once more.
"In fact," Amaterasu continued, "strange as this may sound, it is possible that some of the things I must say are better suited to the languages of the Sororaya. The mortals have always lived beneath one kind of darkness or another. That is among the reasons we named them Sunset Children when they first came to Austenard."
She paused.
"The man children, the mortals, have many ideas of what happens after they die, and wrangle about who is right and who is wrong. These disagreements often come to bloodshed, as if they wish to dispatch messengers who could discover the answer to their dispute. Such messengers, as far as I know of mortal philosophy, never return to give their brethren the taste of truth they yearn for. But among the mortal peoples, there are stories that say that some do return as bodiless spirits, although they bring no answers with them. These spirits, these ghosts, are mute reminders of that shadow of death. Those who encounter such unhomed spirits call themselves haunted."
Amaterasu took a breath. Her immense composure seemed to slip. It was a moment before she resumed.
"That is a word we Zedeia do not have. But
Perhaps we should.
The silence, but for the murmur of delicate wings, was absolute.
We fled out of the uttermost east, thinking to escape that unbeing that overwhelmed our garden land. That story is known to all but the mortal boy. Even those of our children born after the flight from Aswa take it in with their mother's milk. And so it will not be told again here. When we reached this new land, we thought we had escaped that shadow. But a piece of it came with us. That stain, that shadow, is part of us. Just as the mortal men and women of Austin Ard cannot escape the shadow of their own dying. We are an old people. We do not fight the unfightable. That is why we fled Venia Dose, rather than be unmade in a fruitless struggle. But the curse of our race is not that we refuse to throw down our lives in purposeless defiance of the great shadow, but that we instead clasped the shadow to ourselves and hug it tightly, gleefully, nursing it as we would a child. We brought the shadow with us. Perhaps no living, reasoning thing can be without such shadow. But we, Zidaya, despite our lives, beside which the spans of mortals are like fireflies, still we cannot ignore that shadow that is death. We cannot ignore the knowledge of unbeing. Instead, we carry it with us, like a brooding secret. The mortals must die, and they are frightened by that. We, who were once of the garden, must also die, although our span is vastly greater. But we each embrace our death, from the moment we first open our eyes, making it an insoluble part of us. We yearn for its complete embrace, even as the centuries roll by. While around us, the death-fearing mortals breed and drop like mice. We make our death the core of our being, our private and innermost friend, letting life spin past as we enjoy unbeing's grave company. We would not give Royan Vey's children the secret of our near immortality, though they were stock of the same tree. We denied eternal life to Royan's folk, the Tinokedeia, even as we clasped death tighter and tighter to our own bosoms. We are haunted, my children. The mortal word is the only correct one. We are haunted.
He did not understand most of what First Grandmother said, but Amarasu's voice worked on Simon like the scolding of a loving parent. He felt small and unimportant, but reassured that the voice was there and that it spoke to him. The Scythi around him maintained their careful impassivity.
Then the shipmen came,
Amarasu said, her voice deepening,
and were not content to live and die within the walls of Austin Ard, as the mortal mice before them had been. They were not satisfied with the morsels we tossed to them. We Zedeia could have stopped their depredations before they became great. But instead we grieved over the loss of beauty, while secretly rejoicing. Our death was coming. A glorious and final ending that would make the shadows real. My husband, Io Negato, was one such. His gentle, poetic heart loved death more than it ever loved his wife
are sons of his loins.
For the first time, a quiet whisper began to travel through the assembly, an uneasy murmur scarcely louder than the rustle of the butterflies overhead. Amaterasu smiled sadly.
It is hard to hear such things, she said. But this is a time when truth must be spoken. Of all the Zedaya, only one truly did not yearn for quiet oblivion. He was my son, Inneluki, and he burned. I do not mean the manner of his dying. That may be seen as a cruel irony, or as a fated inevitability. No, Inneluki burned with life, and his light dispelled the shadows, at least some of them. All know what happened. All know that Inneluki slew his gentle father, that he was then unmade at the last, bringing Aswa to destruction as he struggled to save himself and all his folk from oblivion. But his fires were so fierce that he could not go peacefully into the shadows beyond life. I curse him for what he did to my husband and his people and himself. But my mother's heart is still proud. By the ships that brought us, he burned then, and he burns still. Inneluki will not die.
Amaterasu lifted a hand as a fresh spatter of whispering rolled through the Yasura.
Peace, children, peace, she cried. First grandmother has not herself embraced that shadow. I do not praise him for what he is now, only for the fierce spirit that no other showed. When such a spirit was the only thing that could save us from ourselves. And he did save us, for his resistance and even his madness gave others the will to flee here, to the house of our exile.
She lowered her hand.
No, my son embraced hatred. It kept him from dying a true death. But it was a flame even hotter than his own, and it has consumed him. There is nothing